This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Natalie Handel. She is currently a New York poet and is the author of several books, most recently Love and Strange Horses, which won the 2011 Gold Medal Independent Publisher Book Award, and Poet in Andalusia, released this year by the University of Pittsburgh Press. This press published both books. Handel is also the editor of The Poetry of Arab Women, a contemporary anthology. She is a professor at Columbia University. Welcome, Natalie.
Wonderful to be here with you, Catherine. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, before turning to your poems, let's get to know you a little. I've read that you were born in Haiti, to Palestinian parents from Bethlehem, and that you have lived in Europe, the Caribbean, Latin America, and the Arab world. How is it that you've lived in so many different places?
Yes. Well, I come from a rather big family from Bethlehem. And as you are aware, the situation in the Holy Land has deteriorated. And they moved and they weren't really able to go back because the situation wasn't... it was always very difficult, and unfortunately, today Bethlehem is separated from Jerusalem. Bethlehem and Jerusalem were always sister cities,
right?
And today, really, most of the young when I go give poetry workshops or work with the youth over there, most of them have never been to Jerusalem. But Bethlehem and Jerusalem is 10 minutes away.
Right.
And it's a beautiful and wonderful history there. Today, there's about 2% of original Bethlehemites in Bethlehem. So it's quite something. So I am part of that diaspora. I go back every year. My parents were French educated, French and Arabic. My family, really, I grew up my earlier years with French and Arabic. Mm-hmm. And so my parents and... most of them went to French school, so of course eventually they went to university either in Switzerland, in the French part, in Lausanne, or in France, and got caught up, we could say, in the diaspora, and went wherever they could get a job. This was the 70s. They had me when they were young. My mother was 20 or 21. So I sort of started traveling with her while I was in her womb, really.
Really, yeah.
Because... you know, I think it was like 8 months she traveled with me in her womb, and, you know, they were students and they were just traveling, going wherever throughout Europe. And at eight and a half months, my grandfather was in Haiti working, and my mother had me there.
Mm-hmm.
They left soon.
So your parents weren't living there then?
At the time, no. They were living in Switzerland. So technically, I would have been born in Switzerland, but, you know, they designed it differently. And I was born in Haiti. I did go back to Haiti afterwards. So let me explain. There's a lot of confusion with my life sometimes because it's not linear, if I could say this. And somehow I've always, until today in my adult life, existed in more than one places at the same time. I'm a New York poet. I've been in New York for 10 years, for example. But, you know, I do spend a lot of time in Europe and in the Middle East. So my earlier years, I was in the Caribbean and Europe and a little bit in Boston. When around one or two or three, my parents, I have to actually get the exact age, I have to ask my mother, but it was around that age, and I went to kindergarten, and that's how I learned English.
Oh, okay.
And my parents they did not speak English until I think their late 20s. But when we left Boston, I wanted to go to the international school because I really liked, you know, the American system, the French system. You know, when you're a young child, the French system was far stricter. So
too much work.
So I enjoyed that, and they put me to an international school. So I always went to French and American schools, and then pretty much I could tell you, Catherine, that from my teenage years until now, I've been I was in Europe mostly, and in the last 10 years have navigated the skies, mm-hmm. you know, between the four continents.
I think I read somewhere that your mother asked you when you were going to get serious or something, which meant settle down in one place, and you can kind of blame all your travels on her anyway, right?
I know.
It's in your blood.
Exactly. I tell her, I go, it's her fault. She traumatized me while I was in her womb.
No. Well, how many languages do you speak fluently?
You know, I always say, I think none.
Okay.
Because
well, you speak English fluently,
yes,
that's
well,
one.
Well, I grew up really with the four or five languages circling me, mostly in the beginning, French and Arabic and English, and then Spanish. My parents have been living in Latin America for a long time. And a lot of my mother's family live in Mexico. So growing up, I also had all those relatives in Mexico, and now my parents are in the Dominican Republic.
Uh-huh.
So as you can see, you know, I chose cities to live in. I really feel cities are where I feel home. So mm-hmm. Paris and New York for me, I feel very connected to the rhythm of cities, to the diversity of cities, and that's where I've chosen to go. I've chosen as home, but of course I constantly go back to Latin America and the Middle East.
Right. Okay.
So,
okay. Well, let's turn to your book, Love and Strange Horses. This is a book that you put together in three sections, or movements, as you call them. Intima, or belonging, elegia erotic, and terra musica, or a return to nature and the spirit. Each movement opens up with an epigraph by a poet from a different country, Jorge Borges, François Jacquemin, and Yanis Ritsos. So this seems really appropriate, given how your work moves from culture to culture. How did you end up putting these movements about? You know, how did these movements come about?
It was one of those moments where you're writing and you realize, oh, I'm really having a conversation with love, or the mm-hmm. heart, the body, of course, the flesh. And you start realizing, I started realizing that there were certain movements. You know, the first, there were some poems which I thought was associated, the first section, intima, which means, it sounds very Latin, it means belonging in Arabic, mm-hmm. and that's where we first have this conversation with love, with family, with land, with country. And a lot of the poems in that section deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the second section is erotica,
mm-hmm.
and that's me discovering my sexuality. Mm-hmm. Although I have to tell you, I had to call my mother and tell her, Mom.
You have to warn her.
I had to warn her. I go, these are not all my lovers and boyfriends. This is poetry. So there's fiction.
It's all a lie, Mom.
It's
honest.
All a lie. I've never had a lover.
Never will.
Yes. And I think that section was also very much influenced during my years in Paris, because I feel I became a woman there.
Uh-huh.
And even the music, the cadence, although I do have that long sort of prose poem, Javier, in the middle of that section.
Right.
Yes. And the third section is a section, Terra Musica, where I wanted to go back to nature, to the spiritual, to sort of the soul. And it is the section where I experiment with language.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
well, why don't you go ahead and read Love and Strange Horses, Intima.
Okay. Love and Strange Horses, Intima. 100 breaths split the air as I lean on the only pine tree I find. It's early or late. It's breezy or hot. The fields are dry. Summer is near. The horses are everywhere. Strangely galloping a dream, but I can't remember how to call them. So I stand up and watch them pass. The first one I rode, in my body found the music of fire, crackling that wind, an unbearable pleasure that also left me with a burn on the side of my leg. A sign, the horsekeeper told me, of longing, a need to return, to belong. After all, departure is like pushing the weight of our heart against the village. Whose name has kept us awake? Raphael came from somewhere in Eurasia. I passed my hands through his mane, saw a history of conquest and battles, a field of hay, a mount of truth, heard a silent ring. His eyes asking me to go with him, to confess something sacred, to name something lustful. Nothing of where he came from or who I was disturbed us. I knew he was different by the way he ran, without pause, without grace, without distraction, without ease. He was told how to move in the world and resented it. He knew he would never own anything. He came toward me. It was a quiet afternoon. I stood unmoving, and we listened to the untitled music circling the earth like an anthem free of its nation. He was unfamiliar to me, approaching as if he possessed the land. Every morning he stopped 5 feet from the river. He waited for the light to touch the leaves, waited for me to look away before he disappeared. One day he stopped coming. I assumed he had finished burying all he needed to 5 feet away from the water. Darkness has no shape except the one you give it, he told me, and handed me an apple, an orange, a lily, and a basket of grapes. I said, "Are these the shape of darkness, or a distraction the heart needs?" One day, as the horses passed by, one left a strangeness inside me. The stranger he became, the stronger his memory grew inside me. That's the thing about love. It likes to leave its mark while counting birds in reverse. It's about belonging, it whispers. Intima. I suppose we need evidence of desire to have broken a heart in this dangerous world. Evidence that we belong somewhere once.
In the second movement, Elegia Erotica, the poem The Other Woman put us in mind of a woman talking to herself, or rather to one of herself, a woman who might be called an adulteress by some people. Another poem of the same movement opens up with, "He undid my corset, asked for 2 kisses. He wanted both of me, the one I show and the one I hide." Are these poems intended as a universal me? Do you think we all have hidden selves?
I do. I think we're infinite, and I think we're constantly discovering the different our different selves, a new experience, someone telling us something, someone we've seen, and something that's triggered inside of us. That's the beauty, is that, you know, throughout life we're constantly discovering, and I think it also playing with the idea of the being familiar and being strange to oneself and to the world, this sort of very private, intimate moment, and this sort of collective moment, the conversation we're constantly having with ourselves and those close to us and those further away who might actually know something about us that we don't.
Mm-hmm. The final movement opens with an epigraph by the wonderful Greek poet Yanis Ritsos. A bird stood there. It said something ambiguous. Why this quote? Are you preparing the reader for a little harder work to access the poems in this section?
Yes, I think so. I have to say that this quote has been living with me since I was a student at the University of London in the 90s. There's something, just a bird standing there and saying something ambiguous, and it's coming from geographic origins. Mm-hmm. So there is something where he's standing there, and it's a set location, yet it's something ambiguous, and that sort of infinite pause, if I could say, put it that way, very much attracted me. And of course, I experiment the most with language in this section. I think it's the section going back to the soul, going back to the spiritual, going back to the self, the third movement, which is the most unfamiliar, which is the most unknown. Mm-hmm. And
well, why don't you read the last poem in that section?
Okay, very, I shall. Love and Strange Horses, Tao Musica. Because we no longer heard the hoofs of horses, because we no longer saw them galloping, no longer saw them standing on the coral shore, we asked, where does the music of the human voice hide? Can you find its song in the sea, uncertain of its waters, in the field, uncertain of its hay, in the cherry blossom, uncertain of its soil, between miles of fallen trunks, or perhaps in the freeze after the heat? Because we no longer saw what is holy and wet, because we call the titans and the horses thieves, and the only message they sent back was, in the end, nature will be roaring, drowning, ruining, ruling, we asked. Can we dare love to find the legend abandoned in musica as grass reaches out for our weeping?
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. This is really a fine, beautiful, interesting collection. But we're going to have to move on to your newest collection, Poet in Andalusia, while we can. Of course, the title of the book brings Federico Garcia Lorca to mind before we even crack it open. Lorca, while living in New York from 1929 to 1930, wrote about Manhattan. The collection Poet in New York was published in 1940 after his death. You wrote in Andalusia, perhaps intending to create a kind of reverse mirror of what Lorca had done. Some of the poem titles in your book bring Lorca to mind as well. Waltz of a Dream, Gypsy with a Song, etc. This seems like a very risky thing to do to me. So I'm going to ask you right out what some listeners may wonder. Are you attempting to compare your work with Lorca's, or use his work as a seed or a springboard for your own?
It's really a conversation. It's really a conversation. And I think you're never taking a risk when you're conversing and having the dialogue. So I have to go back a little. This came about when I discovered Lorca when I was about 17 years old. And as I was saying previously, I had left Haiti, but I did go back to Haiti. And at that time, when I went back, the tension, the political tension with Duvalier was getting worse. And he was soon out, you know, he was soon ousted and he left. And that was 1986. Mm-hmm. And of course, I left and never went back to Haiti for over 20 years. And right when I left Haiti, I went to Spain and I discovered Lorca. Mm. And he, from that moment on, he became a really important, he was a lyrical poet. He was from Andalusia, which is that place where I grew up hearing about. It's where all so many civilizations cross. This right. is the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, and I'm from Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. Bethlehem, Jerusalem. This is the same story, and the conversation there was present. We, you know, coexistence, convivencia, does that really exist? Did that exist in Andalusia? Could that exist in the Holy Land? Mm-hmm. And so all these, there was so much that linked. I was, of course, young at the time, and I didn't realize all these connections. But with time, these connections became clear. Mm-hmm. And at one point, and then of course I eventually moved to New York, which I never even knew I would. Mm-hmm. But I got to New York right when 9/11 happened. You know, it's all these, you know, over 10 years, over 20 years, all these different mm-hmm. pieces that came together. Lorca his journey was 9 months in New York, and I really wanted to go back to his homeland and recreate it.
Unlike Love and Strange Horses, mm-hmm. the quotes that introduce the sections in this book are from poems of Arab Andalusia. Mm-hmm. One example is by Ibn Hazm, who lived from the year 994 to 1063, and it's called In Cordoba. And although it was still night when you came, a rainbow gleamed on the horizon, showing as many colors as a peacock's tail. It's such a beautiful little poem. And a while back, I interviewed Peter Cole.
Oh, yes.
For this show, when his book, The Dream of the Poem, Hebrew Poetry from Muslim and Christian Spain, 950 to 1492, was released. So you're familiar with that book?
Absolutely. Yeah. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. I was in close touch with Peter. Uh-huh. And we've had interesting conversations about this period, about coexistence. There are times he told me I was maybe being a little bit too idealistic about the idea of coexistence at the time there. Mm. But one of the things we all agreed, whether it was Peter or anyone, any of the Jewish or Muslim scholars I was conversing with, was that during that time, they created unbelievable art together.
That's right.
And yeah. that is what I wanted to focus on.
Well, why don't we turn to the poems before we run out of time? And I'll let you select the poems you'd like to read. And again, this is from a poet in Andalusia.
I will open with the poem entitled Granada Sings Whitman. By the river Hinil, lovers sing what belonged to the water. A shoemaker sings the dream he had, his keeper. The dream he didn't. A man sings to the woman on the broken mattress. Death at midday sings on the banks of the Daro. A blind thief collecting poplars sings, and so does the crevice of quivers, the saints flaming in La Sierra, and the men rehearsing a country. They know nothing stays, but when Whitman sings, they allow his voice to take them apart. Abasho. Abasho actually means what's below or the departed in Ladino. And Ladino is also called Judeo-Spanish, which derives from medieval Spanish, and it has elements of Hebrew and Turkish and Arabic, Aramaic, French, Italian, Greek. It's wonderful. Abasho. Tell me what I should do. So when I awake, I see only the strands of your hair. Tell me what I should do so the songs don't break the cellar in the room. Tell me what I should do to keep silence out of our way. Tell me what I should do to keep the sun out of your coat, to find a way to obey the wind, to find the pomegranate on the other side of the revolution. There is a moth. There is a flame, too. Desire is just another illusion. Tell me, below, is there a cathedral in the sea? I turn on the only straight street in my body and discover, when we depart, a confession rises in the bottom drawer. Testament in Barcelona. History can't be rushed. We didn't have time to see the village. We didn't have time to see the house fall, to build light out of mud, nor did we see time burning. The city is missing, and we've saved others, our backs turned. What happened? Is a different reality in everyone's mind. But the direction we took tells us the world doesn't end when we force air out of bones. Now we know the myth. By the cup of coffee going cold, realize we were never told how to take the street parallel to our heart. I'm going to read While Waiting for Death. When you think of Andalusia, death is a consistent shadow. While Waiting for Death. When I die, a map of the world will hang over my bed. The small library in Mijas, where I read Lorca for the first time, will become a cafe. The olive trees I cannot live without will be in full blossom. I will see death from a distance waiting for me, but I will not move. I will die on a train where the view will be of white trees suspended on gray clouds. I will die in the sky where birds will carry a steam of light on their wings. I will die in a car where the windows will be a quilt of snow. I will die moving. As I wait, my lover will say, "You're beautiful." He will mean, "I miss the sea." I will say, "I don't know the word for life, but no, we must play so that it's not only about death." He will ask, "Why do we grow stillness? Is it a noise we are close to, where the stones and flies and trees and birds and echo and earth and what hides behind them insist on music? A song will sweep by us. I will look at him. He too will be waiting, but I'm not certain for what exactly. Then I will think, solitude knows it's where the empty space is, and death knows it shouldn't count while it waits." Tanger Bleu. He gave her a bakshish and left. It was too early for confusion. He collected odd meanings in the Medina. She collected laughter. He wanted more of childhood. She wanted more of the sea. They needed more than their bodies to confront themselves. A flame in a leaf, a cool wind, a fez flying away. She knew a journey was like walking on the ocean, like a prophet hiding glories. But this was Tangier, and it was important to stay lost. So the city took him from one blank wall to another to keep him for asking more. He still came to the Café Central every day, still waited for her to say Monsieur, still needed the mess of images, the badly paved roads. He liked that there were hours waiting by the sea. There was a sun. There was a crush on the ground. The air had broken the window, broken the small hums and that version of their heart. He didn't know how to imagine this. He knew he didn't owe death anything, but he owed love. He knew magic accepted something strange here, but he didn't know where the spirit was. He knew that here you get what you want, even if you don't know what your want is. He looked at the djellaba by the chair, the kif on the small wooden table, the book by Mohammed Shukri. What music do we record when we record? What would she say? Like the drum, the drum, the drum, the ruins and the cliffs. Like the first time he heard Allahu Akbar and slept in the desert. There is no coming back from solitude. Then he came back. "C'est chaud," she said, placed a small blue glass in front of him and whispered, "Nostalgia is just something to do here. There's also walking in the mud, drinking tea, and reading Tennessee Williams. Tell me, how many compassions does it take before freedom turns noise into an album?" He looked at her. Didn't she know the ocean had missing pages? That we had forsaken memory and the sky to deliver belief to a savior? They say a man who looks at the sea knows something about his soul, though it's uncertain if salt is heavy on the tongue, if heroes wear masks, and if, when a man finally understands grief, which means he finally understands history, that's when he knows how a face rots. "Quel bled," he finally answered. They looked at each other as the birds folded their wings, like desire, bowing to something they felt but would never describe. Yes, cities can't grow quiet, and neither can an empire. They keep growing differently, the television on again, the flags rising. Who loves a nation best? They tried to play, tried to remember the day they promised never to hurt each other, but that was when they still had sharp teeth. Now they take each other apart and look at a picture of a city and a man waiting for the same woman.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you are listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Natalie Handel.
So this poem, La Movida, is... La Movida is known in Spain after the death of Franco in 1975. It was just a movement that... It was an artistic and sociocultural movement. So... Many people we know today, like the film director Pedro Almodovar, came from that movement, La Movida. He saw nothing, said nothing. He could no longer sleep in the room. There were many ways to love. What would you like me to see? I asked him. I can't see you any longer. I see you in every window. And we hear the same thing, now that I'm weeping and you're kissing. I wonder what lasts longer, your lips on hers or my kiss now further away. That's the thing about freedom, it bends you over. Do we need Almodovar? Are you watching one of his films without me? Does Madrid miss me? You envy me, I know. Open your eyes, come closer. I'm alive in the light and in your distance and something else. I'm thinking about November. Will you be there or are you waiting for Pedro? The chaos an afternoon can bring.
Natalie Handel, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. It was great to hear you read your work.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
And I hope when you come back to California, you'll give me some good notice, because we'd love to have you come up to Sonoma County and read at the Word Temple Poetry Series.
I would love that.
Great.
Thank you.
In just a few minutes, we're going to move on to the next segment of tonight's program, which features a number of poems by Alcatraz inmates. But first, here is Leonard Cohen performing Take This Waltz, a song inspired by the great poet Federico Garcia Lorca.
Now in Vienna, there's 10 pretty women. There's a shoulder where death comes to cry. There's a lobby with 900 windows. There's a tree where the doves go to die. There's a piece that was torn from the morning, and it hangs in the gallery of frost. Aye, 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 aye. Take this waltz, take this waltz. Take this waltz with a clamp on its jaws. A chair with a dead magazine, in the cave at the tip of the lily, in some hallway where love's never been, on our bed where the moon has been sweating, in a cry filled with footsteps and sand. This waltz, take this waltz, take its broken waste in your hand. This waltz, this waltz, this waltz, this waltz, with its very own breath of brandy and death, dragging its tail in the sea. There's a concert hall in Vienna, where your mouth had 1,000 reviews, There's a bar where the boys have stopped talking. They've been sentenced to death by the blues. Ah, but who is it climbs to your picture with a garland of freshly cut tears? Take this waltz, take this waltz, take this waltz, it's been dying for years. There's an attic where children are playing, where I've got to lie down with you soon. In a dream of Hungarian lanterns, in the midst of some sweet afternoon. And I'll see what you've chained to your sorrow, all your sheep and your lilies of snow. Aye, 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 take this waltz, take this waltz, with its all never forget you, you know. This waltz, this waltz, this waltz, this waltz, with its very own breath of brandy and death, dragging its tail in the sea. The hyacinth wild on my shoulder, my mouth on the dew of your thighs, and I'll bury my soul in a scrapbook with the photographs there and the moths, and I'll yield to the flood of your beauty my cheap violin and my cross. And you'll carry me down on your dancing to the pools that you lift on your wrist. Oh, my love, oh, my love, take this waltz, take this waltz. It's yours now, it's all that there is.
That was Leonard Cohen singing Take This Waltz. Up next, I'm going to play a segment of a program that I aired back in 2008. This is on the poems written by some inmates on Alcatraz Island. I've had a number of requests to re-air this segment, so here it is. I hope you enjoy it. I served as the first docent on Alcatraz Island. I researched historical documents on the island and wrote interpretive programs. One of the programs was called Writers on the Rock, Inmate Poetry. This came about because I found many handwritten or typed poems very loosely filed here and there on the island. I was intrigued by the different topics and writing styles of some of the inmates, the contrast between their public lives and the poems they wrote behind bars. From Loeb Cossack, an imprisoned attorney who wrote a long poem called Last Will and Testament in the form of a legal document, to Al Capone, who wrote rather flowery poems to his mother and wife. In order to prepare ourselves for the few poems I'll read as examples of poetry written by
former inmates of Alcatraz, we need to first imagine taking one of the massive ferry boats from the shores of San Francisco out just 1.5 miles to Alcatraz Island. We're leaving one world and entering quite another. As the boat slips away, the sounds of street musicians and tacky t-shirt vendors are replaced by screaming Western gulls catching pieces of bread thrown off the back of the boat. As the Mediterranean beauty of San Francisco shrinks in the distance, the spectacle of Alcatraz looms before us. This is the Rock, the military fortress turned military prison, turned federal prison, turned national park. Between the time the federal prison opened in 1934 and closed in 1962, 8 prisoners were killed trying to escape. The prisoners sent there were supposed to be the toughest of the tough. Some of the more notorious inmates were Al Capone, Machine Gun Kelly, and Robert Stroud, also known as the Birdman. The men who served time on Alcatraz lived in 5x9 cells with solitary concrete walls on 3 sides. The cells were stacked 3 tiers high. After years of a cruel no-talk rule, inmates were finally allowed some activity in their cells, where many spent up to 23 hours every day. Some inmates, perhaps as a safer form of escape, chose to write poetry. There were no poetry workshops for inmates then, no tutors or instruction of any kind. No Etheridge Knights or Jimmy Baccas or Spoon Jacksons were produced. Is it great poetry? No, but I don't think that's important here. These poems offer a unique perspective, one valuable beyond the poem's artistic merit. I want to begin by sharing a poem called Arise and Dine, written by an inmate by the name of James Marsh. Marsh spent 5 years on Alcatraz for mail robbery. His poem gives us a clear idea of the monotony that allowed some pretty tough dudes to sit down and write. Arise and Dine. At first, it seems you're in a daze. Then you take a peek around. You roll a smoke and light a match, and again you lay back down. Then you hear the ding-dong ring, and you toss the snipe away. You jump right out and make the bed and start another day. You pause a bit, then gawk and stare into empty space. Then you put on your shoes and socks and wash your hands and face. You take your broom and sweep around, and the ding-dong sounds once more, and he takes the count while you stand up to the door. Away he comes and away he goes, and he's gone and out of sight. When you hear the Louis whistle, you know everything is right. Then your door is pulled wide open. From your cell you've got to scram. Your next stop is at the mess hall to get your coffee, Anne. On the handwritten copy of this poem, Marsh's pen trails off after the final word, Anne, leaving a slow-moving mark across the page. Perhaps the rigid routine he wrote of is so boring that he ends the poem in this way to mirror that boredom. Why bother going on? Or perhaps he couldn't find any more words that rhymed. So who did the prisoners of Alcatraz write to? Not to their country, like the Turkish poet-turned-prisoner Nazım Hikmet, or the Russian poet-prisoner Irina Ratushinskaya. They weren't political prisoners, poets first, but lawbreakers who killed time by picking up a pen. They often wrote to themselves, like Rufus Franklin, who wrote about his Christmas memories. It's a bouncy little ditty and makes one imagine the poet is perhaps a kindly old man, sitting in his rocker, holes in the elbows of his old sweater, not in a 5x9 cell. Christ's birthday is the best of days, for witness the best in man. All that is good and kind comes forth, goodwill prevails through the land. The strange influence of this holy day is felt by one and all, the old, the young, the halt and blind, give heed to its mystic call. So hey-ho for Christmas and all its happy cheer, the ringing of sleigh bells and laughter far and near, the shouts of merry children running to and fro, the jolly Christmas holly and fragrant mistletoe. The poem goes on to slather over pumpkin pie and fruitcake until the last two lines, where reality steps in. But it must not be for us to know this part of nature's plan, how on this one day she weds so tight the brotherhood of men. Rufus Franklin, by the way, became famous for his part in one of the more violent escape attempts from Alcatraz. He killed a guard by striking him on the back of the head with a clawfoot hammer. Some inmates wrote poems to their wives and other family members. I found two poems by Al Capone written on Western Union telegraph forms. Each were written on Mother's Day. One was addressed to his wife, the other to his mother. Here's part of the poem written to his wife on May 13, 1933. Dear wife, we have set apart a Mother's Day from all the days in the year, and I want to bring my tribute to somebody precious and dear. I want to wish all gladness and happiness to the sweetest woman, my wife, for you are part of Mother's Day and the greatest part of my life. All that I am, all that I hope to be, I owe to you, dear wife. With passing years, the realization of my debt of gratitude grows more profound, and my love ever deeper and stronger for you. And may God bless you and love to all, your dear husband, Al. That's actually the entire poem. I ran across one inmate poem that was written to other prisoners about an escape attempt on the island. I was never able to identify the author. The poem is called Gone with the Tide. Now gather around, you prisoners. Hear this story I have to tell of how two boys left Alcatraz, this living, burning hell. On the 16th day of December, with Christmas drawing nigh, these boys bid for their liberty and went out with the tide. The tide was running very fast. The fog was very low. These boys left Devil's Island, bound for old Frisco. The last poem I'm going to share from Alcatraz is also the last one I included on my Writers on the Rock program. Loeb Cossack, inmate number 313, was born in June of 1906. He served a sentence for national bank robbery from April 1936 through April 1986. Since Alcatraz closed in 1963, he must have been one of the inmates transferred to another prison. But while he was in Alcatraz, he wrote a poem called My Last Will and Testament. The first 15 stanzas of the poem tell us who he is, an attorney who had enjoyed the good life in San Francisco, and having lost it, wanted to pass it on to someone else. He wrote the poem in a form that looks like a legal document, each stanza a section divided by Roman numerals. It's one of the saddest poems I have seen come out of Alcatraz. And no wonder. We learn in these first stanzas that before sentencing, a sentence designed to keep him confined from age 30 to 80, he lived a lush life. During my days of glory, I tasted pleasures fine. I had my share of folly and sipped the best-made wine. Cossack doesn't seem to think he'd ever see the outside of prison again, and it's unlikely he did. This poem is filled with defeat, anger, a sense of injustice, and finally, a love of the outside world, and a kind of acceptance that since he'll no longer be able to be part of that outside world again, the poem is his only gift to give. Who is the poem addressed to? All of us. We join Cossack now, beginning with the 16th stanza, when he is shipped to Alcatraz. I'll skip several stanzas here and bring us to the end. They packed me off to prison to wash and wither there, but that was not enough. My way must be rough, since no one didn't care. It was soon they were to house me at a place not far away, upon an island cold and bleak in San Francisco Bay. Cold waters swirl about me, strong winds blast the day, while I'm cased in Alcatraz to end life in a weary way. I bequeath unto you my friendship to continue after I've passed. It does not break at death's black stake, but through eternity last. I leave you the sparkling waters and the blue skies above, and all the inviting woodlands with trees I dearly love. I leave unto you the mountains to gaze upon their great strength, and may you know when you see them, my devotion is beyond their length. All other residuary possession that I have not mentioned here are part of God's creation, all that I love so dear. Now that my will is ended and I have nothing more to give, I pray that you will enjoy them over the years that you will live. And with that, I conclude the Alcatraz inmate part of this show.
And this is Catherine Hastings, and you just heard a segment first aired back in 2008. After all those poems from Alcatraz, it seems appropriate to air Prison Bound Blues. Here is Al Hibbler. One more time.
one more time, one more time. Ow! Sometimes I wonder, why don't you write to me? Sometimes I wonder, why don't you write to me?
All right, that was Al Hibbler performing the Prison Bound Blues. Before signing off tonight, I want to draw your attention to an event happening at the Sonoma Valley Museum of Art in Sonoma. The great poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty has an exhibition of his paintings up there right now, and it's well worth the drive to check it out. There is a Poet Laureate Summer Poetry Series going on in honor of Ferlinghetti Getty's work. Unfortunately, if you haven't gone already, you missed the first evening of this series on July 12th, but there are two more events coming up. July 26th, Ed Coletti, Lynn-Marie DeVincent, former Sonoma County Poet Laureate Jerry DiGiorno, and Jewel Matheson will be reading their work. And then on August 9th, which is the final evening of the series, Iris Dunkel, former Sonoma County Poet Laureate Terry Arrett, and myself, Catherine Hastings, will be reading. Throughout the series, there will also be opportunities for community members to read. So make your way on out to the Sonoma Valley Museum of Art, 551 Broadway in the town of Sonoma. We hope to see you there. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. We started out with Natalie Handel, went on to hear some poems written by former inmates of Alcatraz Island, and had a little music, too. So if you have any comments or questions about tonight's program, go ahead and email me at khastings@wordtemple.com. And if you'd like to check out the schedule of live poetry events at the Word Temple Poetry Series in Sebastopol, go to wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.